welcome back to the Masonic Roundtable, a weekly program where Masons from around the world get together to talk about Masonic news and opinions in a friendly and social manner. As a reminder, the thoughts and opinions expressed here are solely the opinions of the participants and do not represent any Grand Lodge statements or positions. Make sure you keep your conversations open for the public and on the level. To interact with us, we love seeing you every week when we go live on Facebook, so we like seeing you in Facebook land. Or on YouTube land, the chats are always busy, a little bit more on the YouTube side, but either way, we love, you know, hearing what you have to say live, so if you can join us then, great. If not, you can always see the chat replay as well. You know me, my name is John Ruark. I'm a past master of the Patriot Lodge, number 1957, in Fairfax, Virginia, and we actually have a light crew tonight. I'm going to switch it over to Jason Richards for his introduction, and there he is.
Good evening, everybody. Jason Richards here, moving my mic so that you all can hear me. I am a past master of Acacia Lodge number 16 in Clifton, Virginia, and member of the Colonial Lodge number 1821 in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Jason. And special guest.
You're welcome, Jonathan.
Tonight. You're welcome. You're welcome for the you're welcome. Special guest, Barry Newell. So I'm not even going to try and introduce you because you've been in just about everything. So, but I do want to hear.
The show's not long enough.
Yeah, we'll start playing the music to wrap it up. But tell us a little bit about who you are, what bodies you're in, and all that good stuff.
Well, I'm a past master of Oriental Lodge number 60 in Boise, Idaho, and then I'm very involved with the York Rite. So I'm a past Grand High Priest of the Grand Chapter of Idaho. I'm currently the Deputy General Grand High Priest of the General Grand Chapter of Royal Arch Masons International, past Grand Master of the Grand Council of Cryptic Masons of Idaho, and currently serving as the Grand Captain General of the Grand Commandery of Knights Templar of Idaho. There's a lot of other groups. I'm not going to go into all of them, though.
Do you ever sleep? That's the real question.
No. Thank God for caffeine.
I'll drink to that. Let's see. Before we get into tonight's topic, I wanted to give a special shout out to the patrons who've been supporting the show, keeping this education going for many, many years to come. So thanks for all the patrons who supported us on Patreon. If you'd like to help out, head over to patreon.com/themasonicroundtable. And we actually have some really cool stuff behind the scenes. We've got, you know, behind the scenes pictures of our setup. We've got a very engaged Facebook group and chat group going on. So love to see you in there, talk nerd stuff. So thanks.
And on weeks we don't end up doing the live show, John and I usually hop on and do a Google Meet or some sort of live chat just for the Knights and Squires. So that's a fun time.
It's cozy.
As well, yeah.
Yes. Awesome. Okay, so tonight's topic, I have been personally a longtime follower of Barry's blog. Why don't you give a plug for that right now? Because even as a young Master Mason, you know, I was scooping things up. I was following these like nerds like Nick Johnson and Robert Johnson. And this is the only Johnson person who wasn't Johnson. Was Barry Newell had a really cool blog about Masonry. And that's been going on for how many years now?
So I have passed 10 years as of April with the TravelingTemplar.com.
TravelingTemplar.com. Mm-hmm. And it's really just your musings, but you do a lot of really good research. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Is it because you're like writing papers for Lodge and you just say, hey, why don't I just share it with the world? Like what inspired you to do that?
So I started this site mostly because I was actually high priest of my Royal Arch chapter at the time, and I wanted to bring education to my chapter. So I started writing, and I was like, well, a lot of this I can share publicly. There's some stuff I obviously don't put on there for Masons only, but I started writing papers, and I was like, well, I'm going to start posting this. And then I deployed to Iraq, and my writings kind of dwindled. But then I got home and I just had a fervor of research, and so I started plugging away, and it just steadily increased. And I'll read something, and it'll be like, "Why is it that way?" And I'll just, you know, shiny, you know, object and chase it down.
Yeah, again, it's pretty cool because I subscribe to your RSS feed, so like right after you posted it, it pops up on my feed. And so it's like Christmas morning every time. Oh, there's been a new post. You might go 2 or 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden you'll have some really cool stuff. And from a scholarly perspective, I appreciate what you do there, because you do cite all of your sources. And that's rare, you know, especially in blogs, right? You don't have to do that, but it's really good to just start, you know, deep diving based on your references. So thank you for that.
It's been, you know, it's been challenging the last few years with my job, traveling as much as I can. I've tried to incorporate that a little bit, going to some of the cool places I have. And I'll announce it now, is this November I plan on doing the In the Footsteps of Jesus program, which is a 2-week tour of Jerusalem and other parts of Israel. So I'm going to be posting on that trip.
So. Yeah, you know, I'm gonna go off on a tangent here too before we get into the topic, because I know that, like, if you read the KT magazine, the Knights Templar magazine, right, they're, every year they're trying to sponsor another Holy Land trip, and I've never been, always on the bucket list, but I think, again, someone as well learned as you, or people who really are like nerding out on that stuff, would appreciate the history, symbolism, and just everything that goes into that area. So you know, no pressure, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing all of your musings on that, because you get it, right? You understand, you know, the Christian context, the Templar, the Knights Templar context, etc. So I'm excited vicariously to live through you.
I just sent the last payment for the trip, you know, so I'm like, all right, it's final, we're doing this.
Yeah, you need like a PayPal account so people can chip in.
Oh no! Like, honestly, like, this, you know, they told me how much it was going to cost. I was like, oh yeah, here. Like, where do I send the check? So, because it's a good price for what we're going to be doing. So
that's awesome. All right. Well, let's see. Let's get right into this week's topic, because again, having someone who's well read, well learned as yourself, I wanted to kind of like let you kind of pick and choose some of your favorite topics. Again, I could have just spun the wheel on your blog and just picked one at random, but I think you did a good job, just from what I've previewed, to see, you know, kind of what kind of symbology you're interested in. So I'm just going to hand it over to you to let you roll. And Jason, you and I can just kind of jump in whenever. Barry gave us permission to just do that, so we don't have to ask for permission. We can just hop in and throw virtual tomatoes. All right.
There we go.
So I'm going to switch over to you and let you share your screen. Excellent.
All right. So yeah, tonight's discussion is going to be on Templar symbols. So these are the primary ones I'm going to talk about. We might go off on a few tangents and stuff, which is, you know, great. But first and foremost, I wanted to get in on the Beauseants. So like many organizations, the Templars employed a variety of symbols for a variety of purposes. You know, official seals, ornamentation, gravestones, anything like that. There's a whole variety that we could cover. But one I really like is the Beauseant. It's so simplistic in its design, but unique with many meanings. The Beauseant was the standard for the Knights Templar. It consists of a black section above a white section. And you could also see that may have been hung from a perpendicular pole so that the two colors were side by side. The Beauseant, though, was divided into two sections as a symbolic representation of to terrify the enemies of Christ, but it could also depict the sins of the secular world that the Templar Knights had chosen to leave, while the second section was depicting the purity of the order, as well as the transformation of, you know, that darkness to light, something that obviously we see in Freemasonry.
I'm no vexiologist, but what's the point of having both of the, like, the different tails and not a continuous, say, rectangle for the flag?
So in some depictions, you'll see it as a rectangular flag. Sometimes you'll see it you even see this in modern standards today. You'll see that that split end, and a lot of times, I would say it goes with possibly, you know, with the wind and stuff. You can see the different sections. The actual usage of that, I'm not quite sure on. I'd have to look that up. But you do see that even with modern guidons and standards used in the military.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But to the ancient Templars, though, this Beauceant was a rallying point during battles, so they could easily regroup when separated. Knights were not allowed to retreat or stop fighting during battle until if the Beauceant was still flying. So the marshal of the order, he would select a group of Templars to protect it, which were led by a officer known as the Canfonier, or Standard Bearer. And the Standard Bearer is an officer used in the Masonic Knights Templar Commandery, and it's his duty to protect the standard of the commandery. Historically, the duties of the Standard Bearer included being the paymaster as well, and ensuring that the equipment was kept in working order. Now, the Standard Bearer was not the one that actually carried the banner. He was just the one in charge of its protection. There would often be a squad of knights that led that. The standard, as I said, is still used in today's military. When I was a private first class in the Army, I was the Standard Bearer for the military intelligence company that I was a part of. And I had to be spot on my drill and ceremony. And I took part in many ceremonies on the U.S. and in overseas, to include funeral rites for soldiers that were being loaded onto planes back to the States. All the guidons would lower themselves as he passed. And being the guidon bearer is probably one of the, you know, the greatest memories and stuff of the military. And so it's something you definitely see that military characteristic carry over through the years, even from Knights Templar to today.
Yeah, just to add to that, it's as you lay that out there, the flag of a unit is really, you know, it's nothing to take lightly. That it is a central rallying point, as you called it, for the division. So it's critical that it's visible, that it's cared for, it's protected, right? It's and so right there, just the Beauceant itself is has more meaning than just a flag.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do laugh. Each other's units, we'd try to steal each other's guidons to the point I had to sleep with it in my sleeping bag when we were in Texas training up for deployment. They would try to do it that
much. That's training hazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I laughed so hard, you know, on those times. You know, the moments when you can sleep with a flag, you know, curled up with you.
Awesome.
All right. Now, the most popular symbol associated with the medieval Knights Templars is the image of two knights upon one horse. This symbol was used by many Grand Masters as their seals, with minor variations through the successive line of Grand Masters. Starting around 1167 to about 1298, this was a primary seal. The official seal, though, was closely guarded in the treasury of the protection of the commander of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, who was also the treasurer of the order, and could only be accessed by a select few knights. Like many things associated with the Templars, this symbol mystifies many, and since their downfall there has been many theories as to the meaning of it. Some military experts believe it represented that policy seen today known as the buddy system, where soldiers, or knights in their case, would operate in pairs to ensure either A, the enemy didn't surprise us in an ambush, or B, that the work would get done properly. Some believe this symbol, though, goes back much further to ancient Sumeria, which is thought to represent a tactical device during battle, but also symbolic of duality and balance. This may be the reason the Templars adopted it, to represent their dual function as both warriors and monks. Others theorize that it originated with the birth and initial poverty of the Templar order, but this would fly in the face of the rule of the order which guided their lives, which established the number of horses allocated to knights according to their rank and position, which also prohibited the sharing of the same horse.
So why would they share a horse?
So that's the...
It's more comfy.
Yeah, right.
It's a two-seater. That's,
yeah. That's the big question, is why this symbol, when the ruler of their order, which was laid down by St. Bernard, you know, prohibited sharing the horse, that because a knight would have a retinue, he would have, you know, squires and pages and, you know, other, you know, he would have a horse for traveling on, a horse for warfare, a horse to carry his equipment. I mean, so, you know, they were a poor order, as in, you know, they didn't individually possess anything, but the order itself was not poor by any means. So it's just one of those questions that we have left to ponder. So obviously this symbol, the Red Cross, is a very prominent symbol, which would have been emblazoned upon the mantle of every member of the Knights Templar. The mantle would vary depending on their class. Knights obviously wore a white mantle with the Red Cross. Sergeants would be in brown or black. But the Red Cross was not an ornament of the Templars until 1147, so, you know, 29 years after their founding. But the cross, it's long been associated with Christianity, but this is a symbol that has preceded the Christian religion by, you know, many centuries. It's been found in ancient Africa, the Far East, Assyria, Phoenicia, India, Persia, Mesopotamia, Scandinavia, and even Mesoamerica or pre-Columbian America. To these cultures, the cross represented often the sun, or has been a symbol of the earth, to represent the various incarnations of the number four, such as the directions, the seasons, winds, quarters of the moon, the alchemical elements. But the cross may also emblematically represent the union of heaven and earth. And we can, you know, from a Christian standpoint, we can look at the four evangelists and their gospels, being represented with the cross. And we are reminded of the fourth day that God put the lights in the firmament to separate light from darkness. But for the Templar, the Red Cross was a symbol of martyrdom to remind them, you know, of the passion of Christ. There are also a variety of other crosses used within the Templar order, past and present. We would see this cross, the second order conferred within a commandery of Knights Templar today, is the Order of Malta, which uses this cross as its primary symbol. You see the Patriarchal Cross is a Latin cross with two crossbars, a smaller one above a larger one, often both placed near the top, but they can vary where both crossbars are uniform, such as this. And this cross is important in Masonic Templary, as it is used as the insignia of all officers of the Grand Encampment below the rank of most eminent Grand Master. And then we also use the Cross of Salem, or known as the Papal Cross, as a Latin cross with three horizontal beams, where it's seen as the top and bottom beams are shorter than the middle or main. Sometimes there's some variations with this, where they will increase in size as they go from top down, making it kind of look like a Christmas tree. This cross is reserved for the insignia of the most eminent Grand Master and past Grand Masters of the Grand Encampment. In the Scottish Rite, this cross would be slightly slanted in the insignia of the Sovereign Grand Commander of the Supreme Council of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite. So,
obviously, is that a stylistic reason?
You know,
to separate themselves.
you know, I've wondered that myself, and I've never sat down. You know, I got to meet Ronnie Seal, and you know, maybe I need to sit down with Jim Cole and just talk to them, or maybe even Arturo, and just find out what's in the records about, you know, why they chose that style.
So, Barry, quick question. Like, I understand, you know, the crosses where you have the two crossbars being, you know, one being the crossbar, and then the higher one being, you know, the INRI sign that hung above Christ. What's the rationale for three crossbars?
So, if you looked at this, because this is obviously used with the Roman Catholic Church, it was trying to look at it as the role of the Pope, and
I have heard of it used. The bottom one has also been used as a symbolic representation of nailing of the feet.
Correct. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah. So where I was trying to find that.
Right. So you have the crossbar for the arms, the top cross for the sign, and then the bottom cross for, you know, representation of a block or something where they would nail his feet.
Right. Yeah. So I wrote this earlier. This would so it represents the triple role of the Pope as a leader of worship, teacher of his fellow priests, and as a community leader. Some also said it would represent the Pope as Bishop of Rome, Patriarch of the West, and the successor of Saint Peter. And so, I mean, this was obviously considered a cross reserved for very senior Christian leadership. And which is one reason I see that it was adopted within Templar orders, because you still look at the Scottish Rite, and they have that Templar degrees within their system.
Chivalric degrees.
Mm-hmm. There you go. All right. So, one symbol you don't see too often, but it is found within modern Templary in a few of our designs, is the Agnus Dei, or Lamb of God. This would have been found primarily in England and some parts of France, but it wasn't uniquely used by the Knights Templar. The Agnus Dei is often depicted as a haloed lamb with its leg crooked so that it's holding a cross or a flag, and then there are obviously several variations of this. But it was first used around 1241. It is debated about that time, but there's no evidence existing prior to that time that shows the use of this symbol anywhere. But it was primarily used first in Rome, and then thus would have been, you know, some have accused it of being pagan use. But you can also obviously see the Judeo roots in this, because it's also referred to often as the Paschal Lamb, which that name Paschal is referring to Passover, and so thus would have dealt with, you know, the slaughter of the lamb, the
sacrificial lamb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so
yeah, you see this a whole lot in older cathedrals throughout Europe.
Yeah. But a lot of, for a Christian audience, the Agnus Dei is symbolic of the martyred Christ, and they refer back to the Book of John when the Baptist declares, "Behold the Lamb of God," when Jesus is approaching. And you see this symbol today. We use it in a variety of ways. I wish I had my jewels with me. I don't carry them on work trips, but
you never know when a Comanche is going to break out, so
right,
you should come prepared.
That's right. But the Knight Commander of the Temple Jewel has, you know, we use the Agnus Dei. It's very small in the center. Most people obviously look at the jewel as a whole, but if you look at it, the Agnus Dei does play a portion of that. And so you would see that still in our modern use. Now, with the lamb, you also see often the lion and the dove coming in here. The lion is a fairly obvious symbol for Christian order, as the lion is the king of beasts, so too is Christ the king of kings. Obviously, he was of the tribe of Judah, which they depicted themselves as a lion with their sigil of their tribe. Obviously, the lion has been used by warriors and noblemen alike as a symbol of their strength, their prowess, their authority. But you could also use it, you know, trying to represent valor and courage, royalty. I mean, there's so many different symbolic representations.
And Leo, the constellation as well, for a lot of the same correspondences.
Right. You know, and then you start getting into, you know, fire. We can go down that rabbit hole.
Just like the cardinal points on the original Red Cross. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, and, you know, speaking of fire, you know, the lion was seen by the ancients as a solar animal, which is funny because the lion is primarily a nocturnal hunter. And so you could then again argue that this symbol of duality, you know, being a solar animal, but, you know, instinctively being a nighttime hunter. So this night and day, dark and light motif.
And a peaceful carnivore, right?
There we go. Because you look at it, in fact, the lion usually, I mean, they'll take down animals once in a while, but they'll often also chase away, you know, other animals from their prey and then, you know, eat that. So you kind of see a playground bully with the lion, but again, he's the king, so no one's going to mess with him.
It's good to be the king.
But that's right. But the Templars, I mean, they may have chosen this symbol as a remembrance of those words spoken by their early champion, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, who described them as ferocious lions. I mean, that's another, you know, topic of study is, you know, Saint Bernard, because, I mean, he could have been a contender for the Pope, papal office, but I mean, he's the one that really set the Templars up for success by championing them across Europe and writing the rule, which governed that order till, you know, they were disbanded. But I digress. Mm-hmm. So another symbol found on Templar seals is the dove, which is, again, another Christian icon. The dove symbolizing peace often would represent the Holy Spirit, but even in some interpretations could be representation of angels. And so you would see this carved here and there. Once in a while, it'd be on some seals, but you didn't see a lot of the dove, not as much as other symbols, but it was still definitely a Christian icon to be used by this Templar sect. So the Calvary cross, or stepped cross, is a Latin cross surmounted on a base of three steps. Calvary is the Latin name of the Aramaic word Golgotha, which we learn from biblical history is the place of, meaning the place of a skull, as there is a skull-like appearance on the hillside, and it was that place where Christ was crucified.
And Calvary being the Latin interpretation of Golgotha. Yes.
Yep. So the three steps were said to represent the hill. They could also, be a symbolic, of our virtues, especially because within Templary we still remember our Masonic roots, and we remember our virtues of faith, hope, and charity or love. And along with being used as gravestones, the places where Templars were imprisoned often had Calvary crosses etched into their prison cell, which is kind of for a cross that's meant to represent salvation and hope, it seems like it, maybe they were seeking salvation and hope in their prison cell, but it's tragic to see it happen there.
Yeah.
So the fleur-de-lis, or lily flower, is a stylized lily, uses a decorative design or symbol. It was first used around the 11th century and then continued to spread in use throughout the Middle Ages. The lily, from the retired state of its petal, symbolizes that it is a symbol of peace and purity, but is also meant to symbolize light, faith, wisdom, and chivalry. In Christianity, the lily was said to represent the Virgin Mary, and there appears many places of art with Mary carrying the lily. Some believe that the fleur-de-lis represents also the Holy Trinity, from having its three sections, part of that. I mean, and the fleur-de-lis, you obviously see this in many French French-influenced cultures, which would be where, you know, the Templars obviously had a great presence in France, since they essentially owned the southern third of what is now, you know, modern-day France.
Gotcha.
And if you go anywhere, you know, such as New Orleans and stuff, you will definitely see this symbol flying around. This symbol, this was a peculiar one to read about. I had never really heard about the heart on the hand. This carving, which is of a heart superimposed upon the palm, was found in a lot of cells of the Knights Templar after they had been arrested and suppressed by the French king. This symbol is symbolic of charity as well as mercy. This symbol would be later used by John Calvin, and with it, the motto, "My heart I offer to you, my Lord, promptly and sincerely," has been used in recent times by such groups as the Shakers and the Odd Fellows. Looking around, I saw this symbol on quite a few gravestones, but in a few of the prison cells, I saw this carved in there. You didn't really see this on any seals or official documentation, and so I think it definitely goes with that symbolism of mercy that the Templars were seeking that in their imprisonment, because the torture, if you read about it, was, you know, excruciating and stuff. There couldn't be no blood spilled, but they would be stretched on the rack. They could be burned. There was all sorts of things that could happen, and it would just, I don't know how they went through as much as they did. So,
yeah.
I did a presentation to my commander that on exactly like what each of the torture methods were for the Knights Templars by the Inquisition, and some of it was just, you know, if you did that to me, I'd tell you whatever you wanted to hear.
Yeah, so we're gonna have you come back to TMR, and I'm gonna hear that one too.
Okay. And so now, because being a nerd that I am, I have a Templar encyclopedia by a gal named Karen Rawls. And while sifting through this, I came upon an entry named Abraxas. And I just had a quick note for the reader to go to a section on symbols. And so as I pursued this section, it talked about the symbol of Abraxas being displayed on Templar Grandmaster seals in the National Archives in Paris. Which was used on a charter in 1214. And the seal, as you can see right here, has a Mara-like, being portraying a male warrior with a rooster's head, human arms, snake legs, and who carries a shield and whip and bears the word Secretum Templi. It's interesting to note that this seal was not used for particularly significant Templar documents, but can be found on ordinary, seemingly unimpressive records dating from 1214 onward. What's interesting is the character of Abraxas. I started researching other texts, and from what I can find is Abraxas is a God written about in Gnostic texts. Carl Jung, in his writings on the seven sermons of the dead, stated that Abraxas was a god higher than Jehovah. He is said to be the father of all things, the power above all and the first principle, and the ruler of 365 heavens, of which we are in the last and lowest of those heavens. It is said that Abraxas created Nuos and Logos, which led to the existence of providence, virtue, and wisdom, which then gave rise to the principalities and powers, and from these infinite productions and emissions of angels. It is these angels, then, who govern the 365 heavens, which was said to include Jehovah, who was considered by some Alexandrian Gnostics to be an angel. This obviously was not a very popular belief in the second century.
Yeah, be careful. You might get burned at the stake saying something like that.
Yeah, and those particular Gnostics were considered heretics and damned by the Roman Catholic Church.
Right, yeah. So why was it as a seal of the Grand Master then?
That, you know, and that's what I kind of was going through looking at some of this stuff. Many have attempted to guess as to the reason the Templars would use this, but without proper records and evidence, it kind of falls into that realm of speculation.
Yeah,
that
I mean, it's just fascinating, though, when you think about, you know, okay, so it's got the Secretum Templi, right, the secret temple, right? So, of course, you could just look at it on its face and say that it's a, it's Templar, it's we're preserving the order of the temple, and yet, with some of the additional symbolism of the Abraxas itself, can become almost a heretical, you know, image or sigil, like you said. So that gets into some interesting territory when you start flashing that symbol around, especially if you are representing, you know, the historic, you know, poor soldiers of Solomon's Temple, that you're supposed to be preserving Christianity. Meanwhile, you're dabbling in unorthodox at best and heretical at worst type of iconography.
And I found a few descriptions, I don't know if I accept them as gospel or, but someone described the Abraxas image, as the human body represents, that it was written that God created man in his own image, that the snakes represent the two great supports of man given by God, Nuos, or mind and intellect, and Logos, reason and judgment. The rooster, being a creature who traditionally greets the rising sun, is an emblem of foresight and vigilance. And then carrying the shield of wisdom and the whip, which is to represent power and strength. I don't know if I buy that description or not. But and what's weird is no one knows the origins of Abraxas and the relics associated with him. Some believe that it started with Basilides, an Alexandrian mystic in the second century. But even then, it can't be proven. And it is also hypothesized that it was transmitted to him from another source yet unknown to us today.
That's just fascinating. I did not know there was a connection there. That's awesome.
And, I mean, you look at historical writings and even some modern writings, some of trying to draw parallels between Abraxas and Mithraism, which then you get into, you know, Mithraism being a militaristic secret, you know, ancient mystery school.
Astrological, right.
Right. And you often saw Mithras as being surrounded by stars. And
as
so,
you see there, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, and he had two attendants and stuff, and so, you know, they try to, you know, try to tie that in. That, you know, I saw one paper that tried to say that the Templars were just an extension, or, you know, rendition of Mithraism, and
let's not sugarcoat it, because this is part of the appeal of the historical Knight Templar, is that you don't know, while they were, you know, set up by the Pope to be this militaristic order in the protection of, you know, the expanse of Christianity. At the same time, you have things like this that sneak in You have these rumors, and then of course, obviously, what they were, you know, accused of before the mass, you know, execution of the Templars. That's what adds to the mystique of this order. Is that what were they dabbling with? Were they dabbling with, you know, the head of John the Baptist? Were they dabbling with, you know, Gnostic texts and heretical ideas, Jason?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, getting back to the Baphomet conspiracy, right?
Yeah, you know, that, exactly.
That getting back to the conspiracy that they actually worship severed heads. You know, could that have been, you know, a play on the reverence for John the Baptist as, you know, as a figure? We actually talked about this last week, John. The veneration of John the Baptist as opposed to the Jesus or the Christ figure.
I mean, and then you can go down another road with that, with you know, the Johannite Christianity of that follows, saying the apostolic succession goes through John the Evangelist, the beloved disciple, rather than through Peter. And so you could, I mean, that's a whole other rabbit hole you could jump down with that, because a lot of those Johannites were Gnostics, mm-hmm. and so you would have seen, you know, and they would have spread through Alexandria, so they probably came into contact with, you know, these Alexandrian mystics. I mean, and it is very possible too that they came into contact with this, because the Templars, I mean, they were in Egypt, they were throughout the Middle East, so I mean, they could have come into
they got around. Yeah, there's a lot of influences going on back then. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, and I mean, there is so many interesting symbols that were used by these ancient Templars. I mean, obviously, some of them are still used today. Obviously, this Abraxas seal I haven't seen yet. I've actually pondered, since I'm just a few years down the line from Grand Commander, is using this seal as my coin for my year as Grand Commander.
Do it.
It's in my mind, but I mean, it's a tragedy that too little of the Templars remains for study and analysis. I mean, I hope somewhere, you know, maybe if it's in the Vatican archives, for all we know, I would love to get in and just start reading everything. But I mean, there's so many symbols that resonate. I mean, we could go on about this all day, but I hope you know, let's see, let me stop sharing there. I hope you guys enjoyed that. It was just kind of I piecemealed that together from a few different papers talking about Templar symbols. I wasn't sure how long it was going to run, so I wanted to cut back a little bit, because I could go on till you guys are past midnight on the East Coast.
We can go on it. We can do it.
I'll just politely excuse myself and go to bed.
There you go. I mean, I guess for you, Jason, I mean, you, since you're not in the commandery, I mean, did you see anything that was kind of fascinating or resonated?
So for me, I'm a huge fan of, you know, just corroborating the Bible, if you can, with archaeology in history. And so looking at the various symbols and the symbology through history and how it's changed, and kind of lining that up with the Christology of the period, I think would be something that would be fascinating to me. So if we're able to get time frames for the various crosses and the various symbols that were used in the Templar order, and then kind of cross index that with how Christianity was forming, or the, you know, the prevailing Christian atmosphere or belief system at the time, I think that's something that I would be really, really interested in.
I think that would be a good paper. It's kind of that evolution of symbolism through Christianity, because I mean, you have to look at it from, you know, from the point of crucifixion to the spread up to Rome to the suppression of Christianity, So then they're underground.
Yes.
To the rise
to the,
of it.
To the suppression of the Gnostics, the rise of Pauline Christianity, Constantine, rise of the Catholic Church. Yeah, and it would be very, very interesting to me to kind of try to correlate and see what conclusions you could draw about the symbology as they're reflective of the Christianity of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would just to add to that too is the symbols of other influences of other competing religions, other competing sects, right? I mean, because the more you learn about early stage Christianity, for example, right? Again, Christian or not, it's just a fascinating amalgamation of, okay, well, how much of what we even stand for today from a Christian context was considered pagan, you know, that other influences. And again, the founding of the first, you know, first 200, 300 years of Christianity had a lot of competition with other polytheistic organizations that had their own rituals and customs, right? Many of them, of course, I'm nerding out right now on some Bart Ehrman lectures about how Jesus became God. And again, I know this is up Jason's bag too. And so it's fascinating to see the competition that was going on about other deity-like humans. Right, so Jesus wasn't the only one at that same period of time that had claimed to be either the Son of God or God come down to earth. And so...
And went through similar sacrifices.
Trials.
To the point
of
trial, death, and potential resurrection.
So you can see how all these symbols start to merge together, or at least have been influenced by. And it's, you know, it's no doubt that early Christians or Christianity would want to leverage what's common, right? That's just marketing 101. You go with the familiar and slap it onto your novel, and that way it becomes I've always wanted that, even though it's, you know, a new thing.
And see, that's what I was
kind of equate the two. Yeah,
I was thinking, because bringing that into it is as Christianity spread to, you know, Gaul and the Franks, watching them as they conquered, what symbols were then used to help assimilate them? Because, I mean, look at Ireland and the Celts and stuff, and look at how much symbolism is unique to Ireland with their Christianity and stuff.
Celtic
and how
cross.
They've interpreted that. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
And so, yeah, that'd be something interesting to write about. And I know when I'm in the Middle East and stuff, I'm going to be gathering as much information as I can on there.
That's one thing I wanted to go back to in your presentation was, I mean, you kind of covered it, but you do have a separate blog post. Maybe we'll find that and link to that in the show notes as well, about you walk through the different types of crosses that are found in Christianity / you know, other orders like Templarism, right? It's just fascinating to see how the cross itself can be many things depending on, you know, how many bars, if it's slanted or not. You know, you have St. Andrew's cross, right? That's the more like an X, right? That represents chi, you know, the Greek letter chi. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's not as simple as a big plus sign, right? There's a lot more to it than that. And you covered probably, you know, 10% of, I think you do have a blog post on there on your Traveling Templar blog. So definitely, if I don't get to add it to the show notes, if you're listening right now, go to travelingtemplar.com. You can search up top for cross, and one of the articles you'll see a really good explanation where Barry goes into all these different evolutions of the cross iconography and what it means, to include like the swastika or the Philfot cross, right? So it's just fascinating to see, like, wait a minute, like, I guess you're right. The swastika in a certain context, let's be very clear about this, not the Nazi
before
context.
It was appropriated.
Before it was culturally appropriated. Pre-1940s, right? Where it had been existing for, you know, a millennia in a different context, has just a fascinating, beautiful history. But, you know, then the Nazis went and screwed that up, so.
The article is called Crosses, and I do. I start out talking about there's four basic types. There's the Latin, which we're all pretty familiar with, the Greek, the St. Andrew, and the Tau Cross. And then I go through each variation that can stem from those, and there is a lot out there.
Also, yeah, another book that I've been fascinated with, and I give it out to people who are interested, is a book called Inner Christianity by Robert Smalley. And he goes into a little bit of some of the symbolic interpretation. You know, the what is, like, for example, what does the St. Andrew's cross mean when you overlay it with the row? So you have chi and rho, right? What does that mean? What does that mean if you view it as a three-dimensional image? Different conversation for a different day. But,
yeah,
you know, so you know, if you have it from an exoteric perspective of, like, okay, it's just a cross and it represents, you know, the regular cross with INRI at the top. Okay, I get that. I can visually see that. It makes sense to me, and it has a little bit of meaning. But then go deeper, right? Apply some of that Pardes type of exegesis on it, and then you're like, oh, okay, now it can mean even more than meets the eye for you Decepticons.
Ha!
Yeah. And I guess maybe for even Jason to understand, like, and the crosses in that article I talked about, they are used with on our Templar uniforms. So, like, eminent commanders, you know, they'll have the Passion Cross, that's the Latin cross with the rays of light behind it. And then when you become a Grand Commandery Officer, you get the Maltese cross, and it's, you know, gold with red. And so, like, the color changes, but then the cross changes as you move up through Grand Encampment and then become the Grand Master and stuff. So, like, every, you could go into a commandery, look at someone's shoulder board and be like, oh, that's exactly where they sit within this entire superstructure of modern Templary.
It'd be interesting to work that back to the prevailing Christian belief system at the time as well. And yeah, see if there's a tie between the various officer levels, the symbology of the officers and their duties, and how those compare to, or don't compare to, you know, what was going on in Christendom at the time. Like, you know, it's one of those, correlation doesn't necessarily equal causality. And they may have just been like, yeah, you know, different officer, we're going to change this. But, you know, I would love to see, you know, what correlations might be drawn from an exercise like that.
We'll get you a petition, Jason. Don't worry.
I think my wife would shoot me if I joined anything else.
Anymore?
It's a price I'm willing to take. Okay, so we're going to head to the final question, Neil. And so I'm going to start with Jason, go around to Barry, and then I'll finish things up. The final question is, favorite symbol and why from Barry's presentation? So we'll go.
Oh, man.
I know. Because, you know, we'll start with the non-Templar, and we'll see. Jason, what did you get out of tonight's presentation?
So, favorite symbol was the first one you talked about, which was the French name of Beau. Help me out.
The Beauciant.
The Beauciant. There we go. The black and white and the duality, I thought, was just very, very rich. And the story behind the use of the Beauciant and what it represented in battle, I think, was really fascinating. And so that's just such a rich symbol that even if it wasn't originally meant that way, it just, you know, that was definitely my favorite one.
Excellent. All right. And then Barry, since you put it together, what was your favorite part of researching all of this?
So for me, it was definitely the Abraxas seal. Just getting into that
heretic.
Yeah. But getting into that Gnostic text and kind of reading about some of it, I mean, the mythology just fascinated me.
Excellent. All right, so over to me. Again, want to thank you very much, Barry, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to know you before I met you through your blog and all your academic contributions there to Masonry. Everything you do for Masonry when you're busy running around doing what you do, so thank you for that. And then having the pleasure to meet you personally at a couple of Masonic weeks and everything. I just can't say enough great things about you. So thank you again for coming on the show. And I want you back for all that other cool stuff you were talking about earlier, all the different torture methods. That's fascinating. So for me, as you could tell, I really am fascinated with the history and adaptation of the cross and the different meanings that go with that. But if I wasn't going to pick that, I would definitely pick the Paschal Lamb as an icon, because it stands out, right? It is purely a Christian icon that gives you pause for contemplation. It's not your traditional crucifix. It's not your traditional cross iconography. It's not your Piscean or, you know, the Jesus fish, the Ictus type of iconography. It is a sacrificial lamb, and it has a specific meaning. And so that is the one. If I wasn't going to choose the stylization of the cross, it would be the Agnus Dei. So thank you very much for putting that together. As always, I learn something new every time we do this. And good comments in the chat. And so I hope you guys keep that going. And I really do appreciate everyone for watching. We'll see you next week. And keep searching for more light. Have a good night.
Wow.